between Cover Oregon and IT contractor Oracle to pay $44 million of the $70 million it has withheld due to the delay in delivery of a functional website. The Oracle Corporation has agreed that it will continue working with Cover Oregon during a 60-day transitional period, following which each party may sue for losses.
As the Obama administration begins to roll out the new healthcare system, there are also plans to prevent undocumented immigrants to the United States from obtaining Medicare. On Tuesday, the administration proposed the removal of all undocumented immigrants from the expansion of Medicare and will require citizenship or lawful presence in the United States as a condition of getting the Medicare. The administration also includes in the proposal that having undocumented immigrants involuntarily disenrolled would save at least $67 million over 5 years, mainly by requiring private Medicare Advantage plans and prescription drug plans to deny or revoke coverage for people who are in the U.S. illegally. Under a 1996 law, immigrants are generally ineligible to receive federal benefits if they were not in the country legally. But officials say that Medicare agencies were not carrying out the restrictions imposed by Congress. An inspector for the Department of Health and Human Services said that Medicare had been paying out tens of millions of dollars a year to hospitals, doctors, nursing homes, and pharmacies for services to illegal immigrants.
The Affordable Care Act has the potential to reduce prison populations, and some are even calling it the biggest piece of prison reform legislation in recent history, according to a report in Newsweek. Although the Affordable Care Act does not refer to prison populations in its text, it will provide care for mental illness and addiction that may inadvertently reduce the number of people going to prison. Prior to the war on drugs, incarcerations for drug-related offenses held steady at about 41,000 people. From 1982, when the war on drugs was conceived, to 2011, that number increased to 500,000 people. At present, about 69% of the prison population was addicted to drugs or alcohol prior to incarceration. In a similar vein, federal mental health programs were defunded and overall mental health spending dropped 30% around the same time that the war on drugs began. The Bureau of Justice Statistics estimates that 64% of inmates in both state and federal prisons met criteria for mental illness at the time of their booking or the year prior to their arrest. Health issues like addiction and mental illness are often related to criminal activity and imprisonment. Without access to care, those suffering with addiction and mental health are more likely to commit crimes that they might otherwise not commit. By treating addiction and mental illness, there could be a reduction of crimes committed related to those conditions, reducing the epidemic of incarceration in this country.
The Portland School Board reached a unanimous vote, 7-0, Monday night on an approved tentative agreement for Portland teachers for the next 3 years. Though some teachers are still feeling a little edgy since last week's near strike, many hope that the compromise to settle the tension between the school board and teachers will help manage the schools a little better. Gwen Sullivan is the president of the Portland Teachers Association. She supports the agreement and spoke with KBOO's Sequoia Wright Tuesday afternoon on what this new agreement means for teachers.
I'm speaking with Gwen Sullivan, president of Portland Association of Teachers, which voted last night 7-0 in support of a 3-year tentative agreement. Is that correct, Gwen?
Actually, it was the school board that voted last night. We had voted to ratify last Thursday. But yes, it was the school board that voted 7-0 last night.
Okay. And it was a unanimous vote by the school board. What are some of the priorities with this new agreement?
Well, I would say that there are many of them. I would say through this new agreement, we were able to at least move in the right direction to better meet the needs of our kids. And I'd say that our biggest win really was in our workload provision. Workload really translates to our ability to meet our kids' needs. It's class size, it's student load, it is caseload, and really being able to have a meaningful relationship with kids. And in that case, the district had agreed to hire a minimum of 150 teachers this next school year over what we currently have, and that's a minimum. We were able to get language around starting a workload committee, which essentially is when we see things happening all the time in our schools where teachers cannot and other professional educators cannot meet the needs of their students. This is an opportunity that they can go to this committee, tell them what's happening, and the committee will make a recommendation, and there's at least $1 million that's tied to that committee to help solve some of the problems on the ground. Last, I would say, there's quite a few changes that we made in a very positive direction on behalf of our students. But the other one is adding additional planning time for our elementary teachers. It's still not even at the place where it should be, but it is definitely a step in the right direction. And planning time for elementary school teachers means that there are more that will provide more opportunities for kids. So you'll have a librarian in the school so the kids can go there, so the general ed teacher will be able to have planning time. So it's a win-win for kids.
Will this agreement help with class size issues? I know that that was one of the main issues with teachers, that they needed help with class sizes, and you just mentioned how this will help the students in terms of teachers having more time to plan and a little more time to engage with the students. Will this also help with class size as well?
Yes, exactly. So because they wouldn't, they said class size was permissive and they refused to even talk about it, we kind of stuck with it in a way that it is our working conditions and it's workload. And so for us, the big win is the minimum of 150 teachers in our schools. And I will say that that's a first step. You know, that's a 5% increase in, or actually over that, in our number of professional educators. And so that will definitely help to bring down class size, caseload, those sorts of things. And I would say that other is the workload committee. When there is a class that is too large to be able to provide an education for students, the workload committee will address this.
How will this agreement impact the class year of 2014-15 year?
So for next year, just the fact that the district will have to hire a minimum of 150 more teachers, that's the first step in this agreement. The other part is we added meaningful language around use of standardized tests and our academic freedom, which really has to do with our ability to personalize instruction in our day-to-day life with students. And so next year, some of the things that have been cut because we have been told of the curriculum that you have to use, now you can start to use what you used to use or maybe even new things to bring in to really personalize instruction. So those are some of the things that you'll see this next year.
I've been speaking with Gwen Sullivan, president of Portland Association of Teachers, giving feedback on the school board's vote on a 3-year tentative agreement. Thank you very much, Gwen, for your commentary, and we look forward to positive changes in the new year.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Not a problem, and I'm Sequoia with KBOO Evening News.
Oregon's public school teachers and principals are being asked to spend a half hour or so in the next few weeks filling out an extensive survey about their working conditions. Questions range from the quality of their buildings, materials, and support staff to student conduct and parents' roles at school. The TELL survey promises anonymity in exchange for their candid impressions. KBOO's Susan Cecil has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Students aren't the only ones filling out multiple choice forms this week in Oregon. Public school teachers and administrators are being asked to answer a survey on how they feel about the working and learning conditions in every Oregon district. Topics in the TELL survey include how teachers spend their time, whether they have enough materials and support personnel, parents' roles at their school, and more. Cindy Williams, a second grade teacher in Oregon City, says she expects the results will be a mix of what's going on right and what could be improved.
So I'm hoping it identifies what our deficits are, what the lack of stable funding is actually doing, what people are trying to do, given the circumstances, to really do great things for kids, and to get some acknowledgement for all that extra effort and how hard the job really is.
TEL stands for Teaching, Empowering, Leading, and Learning. The survey results will be reported this fall by school and by district. To help plan future improvements, anyone can see the questions and results at teloregon.com. Tensions are running high in some districts where strikes have happened or almost happened. Hannah Vandering, president of the Oregon Education Association, explains that people who take the TEL survey sign in with a code that identifies them only by their school. She says the data also won't be compiled in ways that would identify individuals.
It is anonymous. There is no demographics that will be linked to individuals. You know, our hope is that everyone will fill out the survey, that they will be honest and open about the teaching and learning conditions so that we can build the best possible environment for every student across the state.
TEL surveys have been used in 20 other states. Oregon educators and administrators have until March 24th to take the survey. For KBOO News, I'm Susan Cecil.
A 65-foot crack has been discovered in a spillway of the Wanapum Hydroelectric Dam on the Columbia River. A spokesman for Grant County Public Utilities District said on Monday that the situation is serious, but there is no chance for downstream flooding as a result of a failure in the dam. Hydroelectric production will continue as crews work to assess the damage and develop a plan for fixing the crack.
A land use bill on the future of urban growth in Washington County is headed to Governor Kitzhaber's desk after it passed the Oregon Senate this morning. The so-called Grand Bargain deals with the land use for the next 50 years in the area west of Portland. The bill came in response to a court ruling that threw out the existing plan several weeks ago. Senator George is one of those who supported the bill.
For 10 years of my life, I worked in land use, and trying to allow a person to have their children build a house on their farm, the Oregonian, the Statesman Journal, the Register Guard, members of this floor and the other floor would say that we're trying to gut Oregon's land use planning system. I swear if I heard the term gut Oregon's land use planning system one more time, I was just going to absolutely fall out of my chair when you're trying to defend the rights of one individual Oregonian. But as we know, every single time, whether it was the Damascus bill that we had the other day or this land use grand bargain that we had, what happens is in the land use system is it's so bureaucratic, it's so messed up, it's so broken, that we have to have special pieces of legislation to basically get us out of the court cases. What we did, under any definition of anything that's happened in the last 30 years, is we just gut Oregon's land use planning system. We did it on the Damascus bill, and we did it now. And the reason why we unanimously gutted Oregon's land use planning system is because of the fact it's broken. It's bureaucratic, it's litigious, it creates problems. But if you have enough money and if you're big enough, you're able to come to the legislature and get something passed. At the end of the day, colleagues, we need to make a priority for the state that what we do is we fix Oregon's land use planning system for the individual Oregonian in John Day who wants to build a house for their kids on their property who can't because there's some greedy developer who wants to build a house for their kids, and that's somehow gutting Oregon's land use planning system. Colleagues, we have an opportunity to take a look at what we just did, which is a grand bargain, not just for big money folks, but for every Oregonian in this state who meets the bureaucracy and the courts of Oregon's land use planning system and fix it. Thank you, Mr. President.
The Land Use Grand Bargain Bill, which was renamed this morning to the Map Adjustment Consensus Bill, will now go to Oregon's governor for approval.
Less than 2 months after being awarded the right to represent himself, David, a.k.a. Joey Peterson, has accepted court-appointed legal aid. Peterson and his girlfriend, Holly Ann Grigsby, are awaiting their joint trial set for July on federal charges of kidnapping, carjacking, and murder, including the murder of one man on the Oregon coast, another in California, and the killing of his father and stepmother in Washington State. Peterson has previously pled guilty to the murder of his father and stepmother. Prosecutors are saying that the 2011 killing spree was part of a white supremacist campaign by Peterson with the stated goal of purifying and preserving the white race.
Portland hip-hop artists have suffered consistent discriminatory treatment by the Portland police, according to a Vice magazine article from 2013. And an incident a few days ago would seem to bear that out. But the city is responding. KBOO's Don Merrill has more.
KBOO reported yesterday on a Saturday night hip-hop concert at the Blue Monk that was cut short due to an unexpectedly heavy Portland police presence. Portland police spokesman Pete Simpson said building capacity and gang-related issues were the reasons for the show of force. In response to the incident, the city's auditor's Independent Police Review Division announced today that it will be looking at Portland Police Bureau's policies and procedures as they relate to hip-hop music, events, and venues. IPR Director Constantin Severe.
We've received community member complaints, concerns about that particular event, but there are also some other issues where, whether it's in the entertainment district or just other parts of the city, where some folks feel that hip-hop-related events are treated differently or targeted specifically. You know, it's one of those things where you hear enough community concerns. We felt that we needed to take a look at that.
Are there the same kinds of police interactions at concerts that are not hip-hop concerts?
Well, you know, that's going to be part of our review of what's the criteria for, let's say, an enhanced presence. Is it because, is it because of some sort of violence-related type of a thing? Is it based on music? Is it based on people on the bill? It's one of those things where you hear a lot of things, and I think one of the things that our office is pretty good in our situation, being part of the city auditor's office, of us being able to, you know, gather the facts, information, talk to people in the community, talk to police officers, look at policies, and see what actually is going on, and then putting out a report and letting people come up with their own conclusions.
Vice magazine came up with its own conclusions. In its September 2013 issue, the magazine, which is the go-to source for hip-hop culture, alluded to what it called Portland's lack of tolerance, and it quoted one of the city's then highest-ranking police officials as saying, "It's not a coincidence that all of these shootings happen at a rap concert." I'm looking at a report that Copwatch did on a 2011 IPR report, and back then, it showed that even though African Americans are only 6% of the city's population, it makes up 20% of the complaints. And mm-hmm. And one of the problems with the report in 2011, the report continued to show zero disparate treatment, no racial profiling, in other words. And, considering that the Portland police has been called out not only by the Justice Department, but also by the OIR group, a consulting group in California that the police hired to overview its policies and procedures. Why would a listener think that a recommendation or a report from the IPR group would make a difference?
Just one thing. The OIR group, they are consultants that the auditor brought into town to look at officer-involved shootings and in-custody deaths that are closed, and they've put out a series of reports, the most recent in July of 2013. But to your question, you know, our work here is to, you know, gather the facts, gather community concerns, and make sure that people feel that when, you know, there's an encounter with a police officer, that it's based on, you know, the police officer's actually trying to protect members of the community or responding to crime and not out of bias-based policing. So, I think it's a matter of us being able to do our work and making sure that we inform the community that we are doing that work and putting out a product and letting members of the community kind of come up to their own conclusions.
When will your report be finished?
It kind of depends on how long the our review takes, but the goal is for us to kind of have our work product together and done, hopefully in about 3 to 4 months.
I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News.
Washington State University, Vancouver, will host a talk on the War on Terror and the New Police State tomorrow at noon. Tom Nelson is a Portland area lawyer who has represented several clients wrongly suspected of terrorism. This has made him an expert on the uniting and strengthening America by providing appropriate tools required to intercept and obstruct Terrorism Act of 2001, more commonly known as the USA Patriot Act. Among Nelson's former clients is Brandon Mayfield, the Oregon lawyer wrongly suspected of involvement in the 2004 coordinated terrorist bombings in Madrid. Nelson spoke with KBOO's Sam Smith about the ongoing issues with the USA Patriot Act.
Tom Nelson, you're here to speak with us about the Patriot Act. I was hoping you could bring us up to speed and fill us in on what's been happening with the Patriot Act since the Bush presidency. How is it being extended?
Well, it's really spilled over into a lot of areas. I think if you had to ask what area it's most directly impacted, it would be the Fourth Amendment, which is very plain on its face, requiring warrants based upon probable cause in order to obtain specific materials. Warrants must be signed by a judge. That has been the traditional history. But since 9/11, the secret court that's been set up to, I use the word secret court, I put court in parentheses or in quotation marks, because it's not really a court. It's the FISA, or Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, that sits in secret, has only one party appear before it, and has an application from that one party, the government, saying, here's what we want to get. And then they will put a blanket request in front of the court, for example, all of the records of people who use this, that, and the other thing, who use their cell phones, who use their emails, whatnot. And that was even extended further to the point that the NSA went way beyond that by, as we've seen in the disclosures of Mr. Snowden, has gone beyond and basically pulling in every metadata from every phone call made in the United States, and then storing that material for a number of years. So what's happened with the Patriot Act, basically, is just completely eviscerated the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. And it's had applications in other areas as well. During my talk tomorrow at Washington State University, I intend to get into some specific applications of what has happened in Portland and how individuals, named individuals in Portland, have been affected by this national security blanket that's been thrown over all kinds of legal rights that we used to, previous to this, enjoy.
Yeah, would you mind talking about a couple of those cases?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. There's a number of people here, for example, that have had enormous impacts upon their rights. Most directly involved in litigation right now are people who have been told that they cannot fly. They're on the no-fly list. And what basically happens there is they go to fly somewhere, and then the airline says, we can't allow you to board, and you're on the no-fly list, and why don't you go talk to the Department of Homeland Security. They do that. The Department of Homeland Security then takes all the information and sends out a letter, and I've seen a number of these for my clients. It says, basically, we've looked at the situation, we've decided not to change anything in our files, but we're not going to tell you if you're on the no-fly list or not, or whether you can fly or not, and if you don't like what we've done, go to the Court of Appeals. That was applied in two instances for two of my clients. One, Jamal Tarhouni, who's an American citizen, went to Libya to visit, to work on behalf of an American Christian charity distributing relief and the hospital supplies, tried to come back to the United States. But then when he went to get his boarding pass Tunisia, he was refused a boarding pass on the grounds that he's on the no-fly list. But if he agrees to meet with the embassy people, he might be allowed to come back to his own country. So he went through with that. He went and said, okay, I'm here to talk to you. I didn't do anything. I want to go home. My wife isn't feeling well. I have a number of business reasons why I have to get home. And they said, okay, here's what we want to do. We want to ask you a bunch of questions. Two FBI agents affiliated with the Portland FBI office were there. One of them stationed in Algeria, the other stationed here in Portland. And they went through initial questioning and then said, okay, one more thing, Mr. Tarhouni. We want you to take a lie detector test. And by the way, in order for you to take the lie detector test without an American attorney present, you have to waive all your rights. And they put a document, an electronic document in front of him and said, go ahead and sign. He said, no, I'm not going to do it. So he was stuck there for another 2 or 3 weeks while we worked through, I think it was Senator Wyden's office to get him home.
Those that are interested can see Tom Nelson speak tomorrow at 12:10 p.m. That's March 5th in room 110 of WSU Vancouver. Is that right, Tom?
That's correct.
Thanks so much for joining us, Tom. Appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure, and thanks for the opportunity.
This is Sam Smith for KBOO Evening News. Longtime political prisoner and Black Panther Marshal Eddie Conway was released from prison today after serving close to 44 years. Conway won his freedom on the basis of a challenge against unconstitutional jury instructions employed during his trial in 1971. He was charged with the murder of a Baltimore City police officer, but has always maintained his innocence. During his long imprisonment, Conway has remained loyal to his work in the Baltimore City chapter of the Black Panther Party. Marshal Eddie Conway has served the longest term of any political prisoner in the U.S. except Romaine Chip Fitzgerald, Rochelle Magee, and Hugo Pinnell.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for KBOO News in depth on the current situation in the country of Venezuela after this newscast, followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud welcomes Thomas from Wild Planet Radio as Out Loud co-host, as the interview Deborah Porter from Pride Northwest. Deborah will give an update on the upcoming Pride celebration for June. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Rock Radio welcomes guest Aaron Cantu, who will speak on the new police tactic of predictability policing and the violent mindset of Border Patrol guards. Hard Knock also welcomes guest Tina Garcia of Poor Magazine, who will talk about the stop to mass evictions of African-American families in San Francisco. Tomorrow's weather is a high of 57 degrees and rain with an evening low of 48 degrees. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are, well, counts per minute in North Portland is 31 CPM, Powell Butte measures 28 CPM, and Sitka, Alaska has a radiation count of 26 counts per minute. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
It's 5:33. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Rex Tillerson is mad. In fact, fracking mad. This 61-year-old farmer from Bartonville, Texas, is another victim of Big Oil's fracking boom that's invaded people's homes and lives from upstate New York to Southern California. Polluted air, contaminated water, depleted aquifers, multiple health problems, and even an inexplicable epidemic of earthquakes are a few of the side effects caused by this massively destructive drilling process. But the frackers had not counted on Rex getting mad, speaking out, and suing the bastards. What ticked off Tillerson was the erection of a 160-foot-tall water tower built by a company that can provide millions of gallons of water for fracking gas wells. But Rex is no environmentalist, so his objection is not to the waste and contamination of people's water, nor does he object at all to fracking. Rather, he's hopping mad because the 15-story tower stands above the tree line on his 83-acre, $5 million horse farm, spoiling his view. Tillerson, you see, is not just some local dirt farmer. He says he and his wife moved here to have a weekend getaway so they can enjoy the rural lifestyle. He's not a farmer at all, unless you count farming the government and harvesting billions of dollars in special tax breaks and subsidies. Rex, whose name means king in Latin, is the $40 million a year CEO of ExxonMobil. Now, guess which oil giant is the biggest fracker in the USA? Right. ExxonMobil. This is Jim Hightower saying, so what we have here is a case of phallic justice, an upright, cylindrical water tower that's part of the fracking infrastructure, symbolically extending the middle finger salute to Exxon CEO every time he visits his horsey farm. How fitting that a guy who's gained a personal fortune from the ugliness of fracking now has some of that ugliness right in his face. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
450 students from more than 50 colleges and universities from around the country were arrested at a Keystone XL pipeline protest at the White House yesterday. And Portland's own 350pdx.org was with them in spirit. KBOO's Don Merrill has more.
Bonnie McKinley is a spokesperson for 350pdx.org, and she agrees that the protests at the White House was a big deal.
350.org has been involved in a number of KXL protests through the years. I was arrested at the White House in 2011 with 1,253 people. So, you know, it's bouncing off of that, and 350 has kept the momentum going.
Speaking of that, so then what kind of momentum have you seen in terms of accomplishments? I mean, what has the protests over these many years been able to accomplish in your view?
Well, they rerouted it. Right now, not a 350.org project, but a project of Rainforest Action Network and a couple other organizations have the No KXL Pledge of Resistance, and 77,000 people are poised to risk arrest if the State Department sends a recommendation to President Obama to approve the pipeline. And because of the civil disobedience event in 2011, people have gained awareness about the whole tar sands issue and about the Keystone XL pipeline and about many other pipelines and rail cars that are continuing to pump tar sands oil through the country.
What's happening locally here regarding the Keystone XL pipeline?
Well, we've had the work with the Umatilla tribes resisting the 3 megaloads going through eastern Oregon, and that was carried also through Wild Idaho Rising Tide through Idaho, and many people protesting in Montana. So it was a 3-state protest along the route, the new megaloads route. And people in Seattle, Vancouver, along the Columbia Gorge are speaking out against the oil trains, the oil by rail. The oil is coming from the Bakken oil fields, but it's also expected to come through to bring tar sands oil westward.
So these protests, I mean, do you see them, whether they're happening nationally or locally, you see them as definitely having an effect on whether or not Keystone happens or not?
I do. Whether President Obama approves or denies the pipeline, there's going to be resistance. There will be great celebration if he denies it, but it will not be the end of the story and the end of resistance to the coal the coal, oil, gas projects that are causing great concern among many people of this country and beyond.
I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News.
A website that has called itself the world's first Bitcoin bank is shutting down following the theft of 896 Bitcoins worth around $600,000. Today's announcement follows the shutdown last week of the world's largest Bitcoin exchange, Mt. Gox, after hackers attacked the site. Flexcoin reports that unidentified hackers broke into the system, transferring all of the funds being held in online storage to private accounts. Flexcoin has indicated that they will work with law enforcement to investigate the theft. Bitcoins are an alternative internet currency that emerged in 2009 and can be used to complete anonymous and low-fee exchanges online.
23 people protesting the discrimination of lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, queer, or LGBTQ people have been arrested at the Idaho State House after blocking the door to the governor's office. The demonstrators seek to add protection for gender identity and sexual orientation to the Idaho Human Rights Act. However, Republican lawmakers in the state have refused to hold hearings on the issue. So far this year, over 140 arrests have been made at silent protests related to adding these two classifications to the Idaho Human Rights Act.
Peace advocate and founding member of Code Pink, Medea Benjamin, got deported from Egypt and is now hospitalized in Turkey to treat injuries she received while in custody. Benjamin was on her way to a scheduled appearance in Gaza as part of an international delegation of activists speaking out against the oppression of Palestinian women before she was detained by authorities in Cairo. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with Portland area Code Pink member Donna Boyd, who was on her way to join the Code Pink delegation in Egypt.
I'm talking with Donna Boyd. Now, you're a Portland area organizer for the peace advocacy organization Code Pink. Is that correct?
You know, I am not an official organizer. However, I do align myself with the Code Pink mission, and I do participate in various events that they sponsor. Yes.
While en route to the Gaza Strip, Code Pink founder Medea Benjamin was taken into custody by authorities in Egypt, injured while detained, and ultimately deported. Can you tell me where is Ms. Benjamin now and what is her condition?
It's my understanding that presently she is in a hospital in Istanbul and that she is planning on leaving to go back to the United States on Wednesday. The way I heard the story is that she was put into a detention facility and then upon the process of handcuffing her to deport her, it sounded like she was treated quite roughly to the point where she was thrown on the floor. Knees were put into her back, and she received a shoulder injury as well as her shoulder being taken out of the socket and ligament injury at the same time.
Did the authorities ever explain why she was being detained or what crime she was being charged with?
What I have read, quoting what she has said, is that she was given no explanation as to why she was being detained and deported.
Is there a chance that she's going to try and make that delegation in Gaza instead of return to the United States?
I would doubt it because she first has to get through customs and immigration there in Cairo. So if she's already been put in detention and deported in the manner that she was, I'm sure she's not going to pursue another attempt. So I'm guessing I could probably speak for most of us that we are all now concerned about how we will be received in Cairo, if we will be allowed in, or if we will be treated in the same manner to which Medea Benjamin has. There are people who have made it in prior to Medea, other prominent figures. The group of women who are going in is quite an illustrious assortment of women who are making this journey. That can be seen on the Code Pink website. You can see the lineup of the women in the delegation. And it is hopeful that for those who get through and those who will get through, that we will be successful in being able to make our journey across the Sinai Peninsula and have Egypt's support.
Any idea what she wants to do in the aftermath? What now? Is she going to have a response to what has happened?
You know, I don't know what her recourse is on this. I've got a phone call this morning myself from Jeff Merkley's office. We have been talking to our politicians, to our embassy, and the whole goal is to be successful in showing solidarity with the women of Gaza who are enduring a situation that is deplorable with the support of American tax dollars that perpetuates the conditions under which they live.
I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
Gunmen struck the Pakistani capital of Islamabad today, killing 11 people. Pakistani Taliban denied responsibility for the attack after having declared a ceasefire Saturday. It was the worst attack in several years in Islamabad since 2008, when a truck bombing of a hotel killed 45. The attack took place at the city's main court complex, with eyewitnesses describing seeing judges, lawyers, and other legal workers fleeing as gunmen ran through the alleys, throwing grenades and firing automatic rifles. The number of attackers is still unknown, although two suicide bombers died at the scene as part of the attack. Police were unable to apprehend any of the attackers. 29 people were wounded in the attack.
And a knife attack in the southern city of Kunming, China, has left 29 people dead. The attack, which took place on a railway platform Saturday night, injured 140 people. There is no known motive for the attack, in which a crowd of roughly 10 knife-wielding men and women stormed the station, attacking at random. China's state news agency reported that four suspects were killed by police after the attacks. Chinese officials blamed separatists in western China, calling the attack an act of terror. Tensions have flared in recent years between ethnic Han Chinese settlers and native Muslim Uyghurs in Xinjiang province. However, no one has stepped forward to offer a reason for the attack. Today, authorities announced three arrests in connection with the attacks, bringing the total of killed or captured suspects to seven.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org. For Tuesday, March 4th, 2014. Two Palestinians killed in Gaza due to Israeli attack, and in the West Bank, soldiers kidnapped 22 civilians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. An Israeli fighter jet reportedly dropped a missile late on Monday night and Tuesday at dawn near Beit Hanun in northern Gaza, killing two Palestinians and wounding three others, including a child. The two men killed in the attack were identified as Mus'ab Musa Al-Zanin, 21, and Ashraf Nasser, 31. The two men wounded in the Israeli airstrike have not been identified. Medical sources in Beit Hanun said that they received three wounded Palestinians, including a female child. Although an Israeli military spokesperson claimed that the airstrike targeted Palestinian fighters who were attempting to launch homemade shells towards Israel, no Palestinian group have claimed that the men were fighters with any armed resistance group. The area where the missile struck was a piece of farmland near the town of Beit Hanun. In the West Bank on Tuesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers invaded various Palestinian communities in occupied West Bank, kidnapping 22 Palestinians, including four political leaders of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP. Local sources reported invasions and kidnappings in the cities of Nablus and Tulkarem, northern West Bank, as well as the southern West Bank city of Hebron. In other news, Palestinian medical sources have reported that several Palestinians suffered effects of tear gas inhalation Tuesday after dozens of soldiers invaded the Barta'a village south of the northern West Bank city of Jenin. The sources said that soldiers fired gas bombs, concussion grenades and rubber-coated steel bullets, causing several residents to suffer the effects of tear gas inhalation. Soldiers also invaded a store in the village and searched it, causing excessive property damage. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, March 4th, 2014, news roundup from the Occupied Palestinian Territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Genevieve McDaniel, Don Merrill, and Sam Smith. The producer and engineer is Sequoia Wright. KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Kristen Yount.
And I'm Sam Smith. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, it's at 7, it's Democracy Now! With journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Roland hosts Wednesday Talk Radio. He'll speak with Ron from NoKXL, who offers a critique of the movement to stop the Keystone XL pipeline. At 9, we'll hear Radio EcoShock. Despite recent rains, California's reservoirs are near empty, snowpack light, and groundwater depleted. Four experts discuss the drought that really started in 2006 and how it affects the economy, food, farming, and nature. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio, and host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on The Bike Show, Dr. Stacy Sims, exercise physiologist and nutrition scientist, and Davis Judd Van Sickle, biomechanical engineer, discuss the physiology of biking, how the bike works our bodies, and how our bodies work the bicycle. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
We are joined on the line by Drexel University Professor George Cirillo-Maher, and I wonder if you could just start by giving us a little bit of background on the current situation in Venezuela.
Sure. Well, what we've had over the past couple of weeks in Venezuela are a series of protests over ostensibly over questions about security and about questions of economic scarcity that have really gotten thrown into a broader national struggle over the future of the country, in which the Venezuelan opposition has sort of sought to once again overthrow or lead to the bringing down of the government of Nicolas Maduro.
And Maduro is following the footsteps of Hugo Chavez, who was a popular leader. How has he followed in Chavez's footsteps, or has he stepped out of that role?
Nicolas Maduro is essentially a pretty faithful, represents a faithful continuation of the Chavez legacy, although the last year since he's been elected has certainly not been smooth sailing. His policies and his approaches have been pretty faithful to Chavez. Now, what has changed is the context in which he's operating and the fact that he's essentially been assailed ever since being elected in April, in which for weeks and actually months, the opposition refused to recognize a clean election result. over the summer when they went very much on the offensive over economic questions, and we're actually doing relatively well politically as a result of this. However, in the fall, Nicolas Maduro began to take some stronger steps with regard to economic speculation, cracking down on some currency fraud and some import fraud, and this actually won some support for the Maduro government that led to a pretty conclusive victory for Chavistas in local elections in December. And that sort of sets the backdrop for what's going on today, because faced with that defeat in December, some of the more moderate opposition leadership has turned toward the center in an attempt to try to win over moderate Chavistas, whereas those, especially those attempting to lead the protests in the street today, represent a more conservative right wing of this opposition that's taking the route of, you know, a street protest as opposed to the route of elections.
And let's talk about the opposition. Who is this opposition? Are there connections to some of the right wing leaders that participated in the coup that attempted to overthrow Chavez more than 10 years ago in 2002?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we're talking about the leadership of this opposition, that, you know, the connections are direct. These are people who participated in and played a role in that coup. Maria Corina Machado, who's very much at the front of these protests, she's going to be leading a demonstration tomorrow in San Cristobal. She signs the decree under the coup that essentially dissolved all legitimate powers of the Venezuelan government in favor of the coup government. Enrique Capriles and Leopoldo López, who at the time were in the same party, both as local mayors, participated in things like witch hunts against Chavistas at the time, trying to attack them and arrest them. And they were both present at a very controversial siege of the Cuban embassy, in which the Cuban embassy was actually attacked and had its power cut and you know, in an attempt to get Chavistas out of there. So these are people who were no stranger to this kind of activity, and they're certainly not, they do not have a democratic track record, let's put it that way.
What about some of these claims that Maduro has cut off the internet in certain areas, or has tried to keep people from getting information? Is there anything to that?
There are a couple of things that certainly are true. One is that the government blocked the transmissions of a right-wing Colombian station into Venezuela, and there's a lot to be said about that, especially the relationship between this channel and the former narco-fascist president of Colombia, Alvaro Uribe, and the political positions that it's taken. And then there was also a period in which the government blocked the tweeting of certain images, or, you know, I'm not sure exactly how it manifests, but there was, you know, the sense that some images were blocked. And what the government's approach is, and just so we grasp it clearly, is not that it's certainly not one that we're trained to think of in the U.S., that there's a sort of absolute freedom of the press, because especially as a result of the coup in 2002, there's also been the argument that the Venezuelan people have a right to fairness in media. And certainly every country on earth limits on some level what can be said with regard to things that will provoke, incite violence. And that's the argument, at least, that the Venezuelan government used for some of these interventions. But we should bear in mind that these are very small interventions. Twitter has been the vehicle by which these protests have been driven, and certainly not limited its impact at all.
What about the role of oil? It's been a large part of Venezuela's history, and I understand the nationalized oil has been something that some of these multinational companies have wanted to get their hands on in Venezuela. Do you think that's playing a role here?
Certainly, it's playing a massive role, and it's also playing a role in the contemporary difficulties. A lot of the question with regard to shortages has a lot to do with how imports operate under a petro state. And so it's been a very difficult struggle for the government to attempt to, you know, to on the one hand use oil to benefit most Venezuelans while dealing with these sort of structural difficulties that come along with it. But if we're talking about this current unrest, it's everything to do with oil and control over it, because power in Venezuela is very much mediated through the state, because that's where the oil is. And so when Chavez displaced the traditional political classes, he also displaced their access to oil wealth, which is very often used for corruption and siphoned off. But he also then proceeded, and the Venezuelan government proceeded to gradually raise the amount that foreign oil corporations need to pay as a percentage of their profits to be active in Venezuela. And that has certainly led to the several companies leaving Venezuela, not refusing to operate on those terms. And other companies would certainly love to see that reversed, because before they were paying, you know, they were extracting Venezuelan oil and paying the Venezuelan people almost nothing for it.
Do you see any possibility of there being U.S. involvement in what is happening right now with these attempts to remove Maduro or to question his legitimacy as a leader?
In the overall scheme of things, the U.S. government is absolutely involved in and would like to see the replacement of this government. You know, Obama has just requested, again, $5 million for Venezuelan opposition groups. It is no secret, it's an open secret, that the U.S. government supports these very same groups that are in the streets and that are trying to defeat Chavismo by unconstitutional means or through elections. The question as to whether or not they're actually directing this, I think is less clear. This Venezuelan opposition makes terrible decisions all the time, and it seems to be another terrible decision that they've made. But I do know, and I know this from sources, that the U.S. Embassy is very involved, that there have been leaked conversations with some of these leaders referring to their friends at the Department of State, that the U.S. Embassy in Venezuela has been attempting to divide Chavismo and divide Chavistas from each other by actively intervening in the situation in Venezuela. So the hand of the U.S. is certainly all over this.
It is difficult to get good information in the U.S. about what's going on the ground in Venezuela. Are there any sources that you would suggest for listeners to be able to get information?
Sure. I mean, there's not a lot in English. The best site in English is called Venezuela Analysis, and it has a good number of, certainly mostly pro-Chavista articles in English, but it certainly serves as a good counterweight to the positions that are being pushed in other mainstream outlets and on Twitter, and by Jared Leto at the Oscars, evidently.
Well, thanks very much again. I've been speaking with George Cicciarello Maher. He is a professor at Drexel University about the situation in Venezuela right now, where protesters are continuing to go to the streets and apparently in connection with some right-wing opposition groups trying to overthrow Nicolas Maduro. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the PDX Fusion Winter Event, Words. Words will take place Saturday, March 8th at 8:30 p.m. at the Analog Cafe, 720 Southeast Hawthorne. PDX Fusion celebrates the collaboration between different modalities of expression. Words will feature multiple different performers, visual and interactive art, and a short presentation on creating social change through body-centered communication. That's Words, hosted by PDX Fusion, on Saturday, March 8th at the Analog Cafe. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
No matter how long we live, we never have enough time for the people we love and the things we want to do. Some of us can only afford to leave stories and memories behind, but if your life's been prosperous, please remember KBOO when you plan your estate. Your bequest will keep peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and a commitment to social change alive on Portland's airwaves here at your community radio station, KBOO.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net.
What's up, everybody? This is Goddess of Goddess and She, and you're tuning in to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Holla at your girl.
Welcome to Out Loud, the queer culture radio show on KBOO Portland. My name is Carla, and tonight we're going to be changing things up for this evening. I'm going to be welcoming two guest co-hosts to the show, and I'll introduce them in just a moment. But first, I want to let you know how to connect with us online. We love to hear from our listeners. Please email us at outloudradio@gmail.com. If you have any community announcements that you'd like to share, or perhaps you have an idea for a future radio show, or maybe you'd like to get involved, we welcome your participation. If you'd like to find out how to volunteer at KABU, please go to the website kboo.fm/volunteer. You do not need to have previous radio experience, and everyone is welcome to get involved. Now, if you connect on Facebook, you can find us at KBOO Out Loud. That's also where you can find us on Twitter. Do a search for KBOO Out Loud on Twitter if you connect via that social media. And now I'd like to move into introducing our guest co-hosts this evening. Hopefully you've heard of Wild Planet Radio, which is the new all-queer radio station that's happening here in Portland. And Bobby and Thomas are the creative masterminds behind Wild Planet Radio. They're going to be co-hosting the show with me. Welcome back to KABU, gentlemen.
Hello, and thank you for having us back.
Yes, thank you very much.
Wonderful. That was Thomas speaking first, and then Bobby. What do we have in store for the show this evening?
You know, we've brought a couple of very special guests with us today, which we'll introduce a little further and let you know a little bit about who they are and what they're doing. But before that, I just wanted to talk a little bit about Wild Planet Radio and all the exciting things that have come into our